Hello and welcome to the 2009 Full Frontal Podcast. Welcome, Stuart, up to Full Frontal.
Are you all right? Right. Now, we're going to try that again, people. Now, as has I appreciate I've got the dreaded just after lunch spot, but and as Remy pointed out, I flew in this morning from Dallas, right? And if I can be awake, you can bloody well be awake as well. So, are you all right? Yeah. Thank you very much. Right, so yeah, this is the life of the international jet setter. You fly in to have the piss taken out of you by Christian Heilmann. Take a rather dim view of this. So I'm going to talk about the future, or at least a little bit about the future. Some of the stuff that you probably already know, at least some of these things. This is a conference for people who are front-end engineers, and so I would expect all of you to at least have heard of most of the things that I'm talking about. But I suspect you won't actually be using them yet. There should be at least one thing that you don't really know about in this talk. And what I suspect will be the case is now you've heard of them, 3 years from now, you'll be using this stuff all the time. So think of this as a primer, if you like. So once I've talked about the future, I'm then going to talk about what's getting in the way of it happening now, why we're not already in the future. So the intention here is to give you a briefing, a sense of what's coming up, and then complain at you for not using it already. Okay, so what we're looking for is why this hasn't already happened. So I'll talk about stuff to do with selectors, some functional programming-y things about reading and writing styles, some indication of what you need for programming in the large, bits about storage, bits about Comet. First thing, everyone heard of Query Selector? Hands up if you have heard of it. About half the audience. Nice. Those of you who had your hands up, put your hands up again if you actually use it on a regular basis. Like six of you. Okay. So it drops down a bit. The idea behind Query Selector is this gives you, in JavaScript, access to the browser's selector engine. One of the things that's always really, really annoyed me is that CSS has this incredibly powerful way of identifying elements with the CSS selector. But JavaScript never had it. You had all this documents.getElement by tag name brackets three, documents.getElement by tag, whatever. And it's really irritating. Document.query selector, what it gives you is the ability to fill in a CSS selector. So that's a CSS selector. That's for, you know, find all A elements inside a nav element. That's the HTML5 nav element. But it works for everything. You've also got query selector all. Now, query selector returns the first matching element and only the first one. Query selector all returns all of them as a list. So this works very much the same way as get elements by tag name or get elements by class name or what have you. It just gives you a really easy way of getting a list of elements to iterate through. So now, us, JavaScript people, get all the power that the CSS designer people get, which is nice. So that's an example, that's a more complicated example of query selector. I mean, again, that's just a Oops. I'd never tried the laser pointer button before. So, lesson. No laser pointers for you. I'm just going to point. But yeah, so that's a more powerful example of a CSS selector. Again, it's something you could quite legitimately use in a CSS style sheet, and now you can do exactly that from JavaScript. And you've got, if you're in a modern browser where you've got selectors like nth child, then absolutely, just go ahead and use them from JavaScript. So it makes it really easy to do things like strike tables, for example, which is really handy. Second thing I would talk about is functional programming. Now, functional programming is a thing that everyone learns at university, and then they forget all about from then on. So you learn Haskell to solve a peg solitaire game, and then you never touch any of it again. And people write really complicated academic papers about how functional programming will come in and save us, and no one actually cares because it's really irritating. But JavaScript is actually a really quite strongly functional language. So, excuse me. One example of this is array.4each. Everyone heard about 4each? Lots of nods, which is good. This is the sort of thing that tends to show up in libraries quite a lot. So at the moment, the way everyone iterates a list is like that. You do it with a perfectly ordinary for loop. And the point is, don't do it that way. What we actually need is list.forEach. Every array element in JavaScript has a forEach method on it. And that lets you just walk through, iterate through the list, and then for each one, it calls your internal function. Now, one of the advantages of doing it this way, those of you who are jQuery programmers will know what I'm talking about here. One of the advantages of doing it this way is that you automatically get access to closures. If you're trying to do closures in the old-fashioned, annoying way, then it becomes really quite awkward. Take a seat, gentlemen. Bloody Jeremy Keith. But the advantage with using the functional methods is you get to operate in a kind of a functional way. So you get closures for free. It makes for a much cleaner programming style. Those of you, how many of you have used jQuery for more than just fiddling about? Everybody. Who hasn't used jQuery? Some dude at the back like, I work for Yahoo. So since you've used jQuery, you'll have an idea of the jQuery style leads you to do closures an awful lot. And you end up automatically using the power of them. And this pulls all that stuff down into JavaScript, the kind of functional programming style, functional programming methodology. So you've got list.forEach. You've also got things like every, which is rather nice. The every method on a list will return true. You pass it a function, and then the every method returns true if that function returns true for everything in the list. So it's a very quick way of saying, does every element in this list have background color red, for example? Does every element in this list have the following attribute on it? It's a quick way of taking a thing, say a list that you got from Crew Selector All, and then very quickly assessing whether it happens. And because if you're using it from a JavaScript library, then it's quite cool, but it's quite slow because it's done in JavaScript. But with these things being actually in the browser, actually supplied by the browser, which they are by practically every browser these days, with one notable exception, if they're actually built into the browser, then they're always really, really fast because they're actually down in browser engine level. So you've also got list.filter, list.map, list.indexOf. List.indexOf is nice. It's just like string.indexOf, except it works on lists, which is great. Filter allows you to say, take this list, here is a function, and then give me back a list where that function returns true. So it only finds the things in that list that pass the function. Good way of stripping out stuff. Map takes a function and then applies it to everything in the list. So it takes a mental shift, I suppose you'd call it, to start working like this. If you go too far into that, then you become a list programmer, which you don't want to do. But, aha. Come and sit down, Mr. Harman. So this mental shift that you need to do to start thinking in a functional way is, the way it works is you don't use this stuff and then you don't use it, and then one day you have a moment of Zen enlightenment and many windows align across your experience and you think, now I'm a functional programmer, great. And they become really, really handy. They're just little tricks just to speed up the stuff that you're doing at the moment, but they become an essential part of your toolkit as you go on. If you don't have them in your browser or you want to make sure you've got them, did people see the release of a library very recently called Underscore? Hands up if you saw it. Reasonable portion of you. Underscore.js basically provides this list of functional techniques to browsers that don't provide it, because certain browsers don't actually give you this stuff by default, can you believe it? So they're getting there, slowly, the IE people, you know. PPK was nice about them. But they are actually very, very slowly getting to the stage where this stuff exists. But But until that happens, you can plug the gap with things like underscore, with things like jQuery, so on and so forth. But you can prepare yourself for the future, for 2 years from now, by basically making these things a part of your toolkit today. If you look at base2.js, which is Dean Edwards' library, there aren't that many people using it. But he's deliberately taken the approach of not trying to provide extra API. Like jQuery, you basically learn to be a jQuery programmer. And then if you stop using jQuery and start using something else, you are then out of luck. Because other stuff doesn't work the way jQuery does. But base 2 deliberately just tries to provide the things which will be coming up in stock JavaScript, stock HTML. And so if you work with the base 2 library, then at that point, as browsers start using this stuff, start implementing it, you'll still be perfectly fine, and you won't have to switch away from your library of choice. So check out base 2 if you haven't already. The next thing is being able to both read and write styles. Now, this is how you get the style for an element, according to the W3C. You have to get the document's default view and then get its computed style, and then you pass null at the end, and then you have to call get property value on that. And all those bits in red are just not necessary, right? This is one of those things where the W3C seem to have completely overcompensated. Those of you who've used get computed style, hands up if you've used get computed style. Keep your hand up if you know what the document's default view means. PPK, amazingly. So everyone else can just look at Quirks mode to find out what it means. But one of the nice things about this is the way IE does it. Runtime style, and that's it. And it's a loss to me in this particular case quite why people don't just do it the IE way. You know, there's an exact analog for element.style.something, which you can set, but you can't read back in any kind of useful way. Element.runtimestyle.whatever does exactly what you'd want it to. And it doesn't do all of this, which is useless. So this is one of the things where I don't think I want to be in the future. I want to be an Internet Explorer. But they haven't done a port for Linux, so I have to live without it. Next thing, anyone used getters and setters? Couple of you. This is a bit more complicated, this stuff. For a lot of things, you don't need something of this complexity, I suppose you'd call it. But the idea behind getters and setters is it's a small amount of the mental worm that is Java creeping into the JavaScript language. So the idea behind this is that when you've started to build an object in JavaScript and you want to present something as a property of that object, but you want to make it up yourself, do some processing when it happens, you use a getter and a setter. So here, in this example, I'm creating a getter called since I was born. So the idea is you have a date object, and we're going to put this on every date object, so we put it on a prototype. And then every date object has a since I was born property. Even though you implement it as a function, then it comes up as a property. Now, this is not the sort of thing you'd use for a two-second throwaway JavaScript thing. But increasingly, we're going to get to the stage where we're building larger and larger and larger applications. If you look at things like Gmail, Google Reader, what have you, they are more and more becoming an actual proper application. And as we get to the stage of building proper applications, we basically need proper JavaScript programming practices. Chris Harmon has banged on about this repeatedly in previous talks. And while I don't want to take our fun JavaScript world and turn it into a horrible software engineering, you must concentrate hard, wear a tie kind of thing, we are going to need to pick up some of the techniques, the approaches, the patterns that come from the world of proper software engineering. And this sort of thing, being able to define getters and setters to provide a decent API to people, is going to become more and more important. It's currently rare that you, when you're building an application, even if you're building an application in JavaScript, it's rare that you will provide an API that other people can write to. It's very much, you build your application, everyone else can look at your application, and that's it. but they're not programming to it. But increasingly, that's going to become more and more the case as we go into the future. If you look at Gmail, as an example, they provide the GreaseMonkey API. So if you're running GreaseMonkey scripts inside Gmail, they've actually given you an API you can program to. So people can build applications on top of their application. And more and more, we're going to need to be doing that. We're going to give people the ability to enhance the web the way they want it. And as we build more and more complicated JavaScript applications, it becomes more and more hard for people to write GreaseMonkey scripts, for example, that actually augment those applications, do the things you want to do, to open up the web again the way that GreaseMonkey did when it was first released. The beauty of GreaseMonkey when it first came out is it let me take a website that I kind of liked but didn't quite like and then say, I'm going to make it better. I'm going to move this stuff around and I'm going to make it so when I click this button, it does something completely different. I'm going to add Ajax functionality to websites that don't currently have it. But if you've got a website that's built entirely with JavaScript, you can't do that. It's essentially impossible to augment a website with complicated JavaScript because you can't read it anymore. Everyone minifies their JavaScript for speed, and because the Yahoo people whine at us if we don't. Everyone compresses stuff, and all the variable names are very short, and you've got no idea what it's doing. So if we're going to do that, which we need to do, then we need to start thinking about making our websites a platform on which other people can build. To do that, you need to deliver APIs. To deliver APIs, you need things like getters and setters. So the API, so the object model, the things that people see in your website so they can fiddle about with it, makes sense to them. They provide a nice, convenient, clean API that people can write on. And then you've got the advantage that you can change the underlying implementation. You can fiddle about with your stuff however you want. As long as you keep presenting the same API, it just carries on working. So this is something that comes from the wider world of real programming, but it's going to start filtering into what we do, so stay awake. This is the other way of doing it. If you look, this is this __ define getter thing. It works, but it looks kind of ugly. The other way of doing it is the Mozilla people actually augmented the syntax of JavaScript. So you can, on an object, define a getter with get space and then the name of the thing. Define a setter with set space and the name of the thing. So this actually looks a bit nicer, but it requires an enhancement to the JavaScript syntax. So if you try doing this in a browser that doesn't support it at all, it'll blow up with an error because it doesn't know how to parse it. This will just say, define getter doesn't exist, and you can trap that. Actual syntax errors are a bit harder to deal with. Next thing to talk about is storage, specifically client-side storage, is not server stuff. So everyone heard about the global storage object? Hands up. Some of you. The idea behind this is basically it's cookies but turned up to 11 and not really annoying. when did I start writing JavaScript? 10, 12 years ago? Can't be that long ago. 10 years ago, maybe. And every single time I've had to set or get or read a cookie from JavaScript, every time, and I'm not kidding, I have gone to quirks mode, and I've copied PPK's read cookie function and PPK's set cookie function and PPK's erase cookie function because I can never remember how they work because it's stupid. The idea behind global storage is that it gives you a way of setting a key with a value for the website that you're on, and then you can read it back later, but it's sane. You know, it's a nice, convenient, sane API. So global storage, square brackets, and then the website you're on, the domain, and that gives you basically a hash, an object, a dictionary, and then you just create anything you like in it, so visits. And then I stash the number 0 in it if it's empty, and then I'll just add 1 to it every go. So it works just like a cookie, except that it's not completely ridiculous. Much like cookies, you can't store arbitrary things in it, but you can store relatively complicated stuff in it, and for most of the time, you don't need it. This is just really, really easy. It makes it much simpler. You don't have ridiculous limits like you can only store 4K, you can only store 20 cookies. You don't have to think about, but what if I want to store 21 values? Oh, I know. I'll take one of the cookies and I'll make it 2 values, and then I'll put a comma in between them. So you don't have to do any of this stuff. It's just really, really easy to do. It is, I confess, a loss to me why you have to fill in the name of the website you're on, since the browser knows. But that's just the way it is, and you have to live with it. This is a dead simple way of doing things. It's useful now. When I write Grease Monkey scripts for things, and I want to store information offline, this is the way I do it, right now. You know, this is not something which needs to be pushed off to the future. If you look at Aaron Boodman, did a notebook thing. So you could write a page, you could write text, and it would store it offline and then bring it back to you when you came back to the page again. And that was done with this. You know, it's just a ridiculously easy, simple way of storing bits of data. So use it. IE doesn't quite do the same thing, but it has a thing called user data. This goes on the list of stuff that the IE team thought up and implemented, and no one cared. And then a load of people with Macs came along and went, "We're the new web people. Yes, we are. Use our cool thing." And everyone went, "Wow, that's brilliant. Ajax." And the IE team were like, "We invented this in 1996. No one listened." User data behaviors are exactly the same. They are basically global storage, except they've been around since, I think, IE4. And nobody used them because they were an IE-specific feature. And now, because they got it, the Microsoft team are a bit loath to say, "Oh, I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll chuck away the thing we've got and implement it your way instead." But they will do. I'm not sure if it's in IE8. It might be. PPK will know. But you have user data in IE, so you have this functionality, this ability to store little offline cookies very, very easily in almost all the browsers. The other alternative is SQL storage. People seen this? The idea that you get a SQL database that you can store stuff in. It just entirely from client-side JavaScript. I mean, it is minorly amazing. I have to admit it. The global storage stuff is very much, you know, name of a thing, the number two. This is a full-on SQL database built into the browser. You can do anything you want with this. It's really quite amazing, the flexibility, the power that it gives you. And the API is quite nice, db.execute SQL, whatever. The problem is that the SQL stuff only works in WebKit, and the global storage stuff only works everywhere that isn't WebKit. Which means that if you think, "I know what I want to do, I want to store the number 3 so I can get back to it later," you are shit out of luck, which is unfortunate. I like the SQL. Part of the problem with the SQL stuff, and part of the reason why it's not really made it officially into a spec that's definitely going to be implemented, is because specifying a SQL API is really quite hard. And what the WebKit people did was they just went, "Well, it'll just be SQLite, won't it?" Kind of wave hands. And then people say, Microsoft say, "Well, we're not embedding SQLite. What we want to embed is that little noddy version of SQL Server that you get, desktop engine or whatever." And then the SQL won't be compatible, at which point it suddenly stops working again. Specifying a SQL API is really quite hard. So I would like to see global storage appear everywhere, because then everyone can use it. Then the SQL stuff, if you've got it, use it, and that's nice and whatever, but it's not really a critical thing that needs to happen for the success. But yeah, so no consistent database API, which is sad, but you have database APIs. You have the ability to not use cookies. Anytime you find yourself using cookies, think to yourself, "I'm not going to use cookies, I'm going to do this." Cookies need to die. They are horrid. And then the other thing is server sent events. Now, where's Chris Mills? There he is at the back. You'll like this. This is a bit of code. The bit at the top is in red because it's PHP. But it was a convenient, easy way to show you how to do this. The idea behind this is it builds Comet into the browser. At the moment, Comet's a massive, hysterical pain. It's all very clever, and it's all wrapped up by Dojo or jQuery or what have you. You can use a library to do it. But the idea of doing long polling and complicated stuff like that is just really irritating. And it's basically this big collection of hacks which realistically are not the way that we're going to build the information delivery environment of the future. Right? We're not going to be able to do this by relying on the fact that in Microsoft you can create a HTML file object that isn't documented. We need to actually do it a bit of a more proper way. And This was a proposal for server-sent events. The idea behind this is you use the event source element and point it at a URL. That URL, what it does is it serves a stream, a text stream, with names of events in them. The browser takes care of just watching that stream. And then every time you want to send an event from the server to the JavaScript in the client, you just send something. So here we send a thing called server time, yes, with what the time is. And then your event source object on the client side just fires an event when it gets it. That's comment. It's built in. It's trivially easy to do. It's an unbelievably excellent suggestion, and the only flaw with it is that only Opera supports it. Which means that only Chris Mills gets to use. How many people in here are using Opera as their primary browser? Nice. Not Mills. This is... I actually don't understand. If there's anyone in here from Mozilla or from the IE team or whatever, I'd love to know why this isn't being implemented everywhere, because it seems a perfectly obvious extension to me, a way of getting past the dreadful, dreadful collection of hacks and bodges that we currently use to deliver real-time stuff to the browser. And it actually makes it really, really easy. You can use any server-side language. This could be, this thing at the top could be Django or Rails or ASP, if that's what floats your boat. And it really takes this idea that we've started to work with of delivering real-time stuff for more than just, look, I can build a chat client. You know, actually giving people real-time delivered data as they want it, when they want it. And actually makes it really, really easy to implement, which is important. So, one day, at some point, you'll have all this stuff. I mean, I've skimmed through a few things that are what's coming up. There's a lot more of it. If you look through the HTML5 stuff, it implies a load of JavaScript support that we don't already have. And there are loads more functions being added every day by every browser manufacturer, because it's the browser wars again, like 1997, yeah. But the key point about this is all this stuff will be available. 2 years from now, 3 years from now, pretty much all of this stuff is available now. I haven't listed anything which isn't supported anywhere. Most of it is in Safari and Mozilla. Most of it's also in Opera. Opera have a few extra things, as mentioned, the server-sent event stuff. But it's not all there yet, so we're not quite at the stage where you can just start flat out relying on this. One of the nice things about this, though, is that you can use it right now if you're in a single browser environment, if you're building something which only works in one place. So if you're building an iPhone application which embeds a web browser, you can use all this stuff now. Or if you're building an iPhone version of a website, you can use this stuff now because it's all WebKit. It's all different WebKits, but it's all WebKit. You can use this if you're building an Adobe Air application. You can use this if you're building a dashboard widget or an Opera widget or presumably a W3C widget. You can use it if you're building an HTA. Does anyone build HTAs anymore? One guy. Nice, Nick. So if you're working somewhere where you know what you're targeting, if you're the one company in the universe where you're building an intranet app, but you've deployed Firefox rather than IE, which I admit is rare, but it happens, then you can start relying on this stuff now. Get used to coding to this, because the difference between this and this site best optimized for Internet Explorer, right? The difference between that and this is that here, you're not coding to a specific browser. What you're doing is you're coding to what will be available. You're just waiting for the rest of the world to catch up. Pretty much all of the browser manufacturers have committed to implementing pretty much all of these things. These are not proprietary stuff that someone's just made up for the hell of it or because they think it would be convenient. You know, these aren't iTunes-specific attributes or anything. They are the future of JavaScript. They're the future of the stuff that we're going to be building. And it's us, the people in this room, who are actually going to be building this stuff for everyone else to copy and read and follow and read the books that we write and read the articles that we write on Ajaxian and what have you. So we're leading the way. So let's start leading. The other thing this does is it helps JavaScript libraries. One of the nice things about it is most of the libraries implement something like most of these things already. But at the moment, they're all quite slow because they're actually, the library itself is obviously implemented in JavaScript. Now, as more and more of this stuff gets pushed down at the browser level, the library suddenly becomes a lot faster, a lot more efficient at doing its job. If jQuery's selector engine just gets to call query selector all for everything, then it's all instantaneous, which is way better than what we currently did. Now, the whole point of a library is to augment the JavaScript experience, to give you things which are convenient, but that just haven't made it into browsers yet. But as libraries start wrapping this stuff, they can start saying, okay, does the browser already provide support for this? If it does, do it the fast way. And what ends up happening is that without any changes to your jQuery application at all, or your YUI application, or your prototype application, your stuff suddenly bang, 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 much, 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 much faster, which is fantastic for all of us, because we don't have to do any work at all, and everything starts working better. So convincing the browser manufacturers to start absorbing more of the stuff into the JavaScript environment, into their DOM model, means that everything we do ends up being sped up without having to do any work, which is rather nice. So, one day, all this will be yours. Hopefully. The problem is, there are things standing in our way. Not everyone would like to see this beautiful, glorious, golden, holy grail of a future that people are talking about. When you hear people describing the future of JavaScript and the future of web applications, not everybody actually thinks this is a good idea. So there's a few things that are going to stop it happening. Obviously, the first one is that it's a bit difficult to build fantastic futuristic JavaScript applications when the majority browser doesn't support any of this stuff. Of the things I've described, query selector is in IE8. And that's about it. So the Microsoft team, to their credit, to their defense, have really started to buy into the idea of making this stuff better, but it's still quite hard. You end up having to run a library on top of IE just to provide it. Now, I'm still waiting on Dean providing IE9.js, which will give us all this stuff in IE8 or IE7 or IE6. And to some extent, that's what Base 2 is. But we're still in a position where the common excuse still is, well, we can't really start using all this stuff because IE doesn't do it. Because most of our users are not in a position to upgrade because they're at work. Or most of our users are not in a position to upgrade because they don't understand what a browser is. It's just, you know, the internet on the desktop. So while we're still in that position, it's difficult to really clamor for upgrades. All we can realistically do is use a library for everything or encourage people to switch away from IE or stop supporting it. Anyone built a public website that doesn't support IE6? Brave souls, good effort. It looked, a year or so ago, it looked like that really might become a kind of a burgeoning thing where people would say, sorry, IE6 people, unlucky. Here is a link to Firefox. But it never really took off. One of the things I'd be interested in is knowing when people think that the seesaw is going to tip over, when it's reasonable to say, stuff IE6, it's just not worth it. I don't care that it's 30% of my customers. I'm prepared to turn 30% of my customers away rather than do the extra work. Now, Google's Chrome Frame kind of does this by basically installing Google Chrome as a plugin to Internet Explorer, which I'm not necessarily convinced is the right way of doing it, but it's a way of doing it. People are at least starting to think about a way of getting around the fact that we're being held back. You know, I'm up here describing a glorious future, and everyone's like, well, yeah, it sounds like a good idea, but I can't do it because half of my people are on IE6 still. So something to think about when you're in the bar is, seriously, how do we get around this problem? How do we encourage people to upgrade? Is the solution just to use jQuery for everything and make it John Resig's problem? I mean, that's basically what I do, but don't tell John. But is that the solution? Is the solution to stop supporting IE6? I mean, I'm pretty firmly of the opinion that if a number of major websites stopped supporting IE6, everyone had suddenly learned how to upgrade. All the businesses that say, oh, we can't upgrade because our intranet applications held us back, right? As soon as Google.com stops working in IE6, they'll upgrade tomorrow. So is that the approach? Should we be pushing our employers, our websites, to actually stop doing it? How many of you would be prepared to do that now? You just haven't had a chance. The rest of you are all chicken. But that's the point. You're not chicken, much as I'd like to point the finger and throw things at you from the stage. There are genuinely business constraints. So how do we get around them? How do we move on? I mean, part of the reason the Microsoft team don't want to put lots and lots of effort into IE is because of the second thing that's holding us back. This is the Microsoft Silverlight logo. And we're now in a position where people building stuff for IE, or sorry, people building stuff at Microsoft, get whipsawed in between the idea of getting stuff into their browser to make it better and easier to build complicated, detailed, rich applications. And the Silverlight team would come around and say, build some stuff with Silverlight. I think I saw, someone correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, in order to watch the IE9 preview, you now have to install Silverlight. Right? That's retarded, is what that is. You know, I mean, shut up, for goodness sake. So the Silverlight team at Microsoft, because Microsoft, unlike the rest of us, have an infinite amount of money, get to do things like go to the Olympics and say, what we'd like to do is we'd like to serve all of your media, and we'll do it with Silverlight, which means they start to increase market penetration. You know, but Silverlight's a problem, because Silverlight is actively against the idea that what we want is a rich web. What they want is a rich Silverlight, no bloody web. So what we need to do is, this is not a rallying call to fight the power of Silverlight or anything, but it's a lie, it is a rallying call to fight the power of Silverlight, but I'm not supposed to say stuff like that. But be aware that any time you try and think about ways to deliver this kind of thing to real people on the open web, there are people from the Silverlight team trying to make sure that their way is better. So what we need is we need to be better than Silverlight at what Silverlight does, which is, you know, non-trivial. The third thing that's in the way is Adobe Flash. Yes, it is. And again, to the Flash team's credit, they've gone beyond the days when people built massive, unskippable Flash intros, and that's what it was for. You know, you go to the website, you should just say Flash, not just for banner ads. You can actually build decent, rich applications with Flash, but it's not the open web. It's not what we do. It's proprietary to one company. They get to decide its direction. They get to decide what's going in and what's going out. So if you want something in Flash, and Adobe don't want you to have it in Flash, tough. So again, it's opposing our future. If everyone starts using Flash, then the future becomes Adobe's future. Now, they'd quite like that, and their stockholders are quite like that. But I want the future to be ours, built by us, for us, around us. The other thing, if you look at all three of these, right, all three of these logos, they've all got a certain kind of round similarity about it. And when I was thinking about this talk, it occurred to me there was another thing with that same kind of round shape and the same kind of impact on what people are doing, which is the Death Star. And you've got, you know, they're coming to get us. But as I said, this is our web. We're building the open web, the thing that everyone can use. So they may stand against us, but, you know, Benjamin Franklin said, we must hang together or we'll all hang separately. But it's really important that what we do is we continue to use the technologies that we've built, that our browser manufacturers have built, people bringing in, building rich web applications, use HTML5, use the things I've just described. Because in the end, what's important is that if we hang together, we'll win. Thank you very much. Have I got time for questions? I'm told I have time for questions. Question down front.
That's a question than a statement. Like, I've seen the statistics on the site I'm working on quite nice, quite big, and IE is down to less than 6%. So that's a good news, I think, IE6.
Down to less than 6%?
Yes, exactly. IE7, however, is still over 75% of our IE base, you know. So an IE7, yes, it's better than IE6, but it still will not allow us this stuff.
Not so much, no. I mean, IE8 was a dramatic improvement over IE7 from our perspective, from the perspective of front-end engineers. IE7 wasn't. IE7 was as much of a train wreck for the IE team as Vista was for the operating system team. It made a load of stuff worse, and it didn't make anything any better. So, you know, whoever wrote down the goals for the project has probably been fired. But if you're still in a position where 80% of your users are IE, what do? Chrome Frame? Use jQuery for everything? Use YUI for everything, whatever? There are things you can do, but we probably ought to concentrate on sites that are getting 30 or 40% IE usage first before we start concentrating on things where you're still getting 80% IE heads. I mean,
no, it's actually it's 75% of all the IE users use IE7, but IE is down to 60 or 70%.
Ah, right, okay, so we're getting there. Yeah. Slowly we're getting there. What else? Question at the back. Question at the front as well, apparently.
Oh, sorry, did I just...
No, go.
Hi, you talked about Comet briefly. I don't know how long or short an answer it would be, but with the technology that we've got currently, cross-browser, maybe forgetting about IE6, what's the sort of our best shot at that kind of... emulating push kind of stuff?
Dojo is your best shot at this. Other browsers will do it, and you can build your own thing, but if you want to do anything that's advanced today, Dojo will almost certainly have an implementation and had an implementation in 2005 before anyone even knew what it was. If you want to do Comet, use a library. Most of the libraries provide some support for it. I know YUI does various things around this. But what I'd do is I'd start with Dojo first because you know you'll get a seamless, relatively easy to use experience, and then that'll give you a sense of how to build things with it, how to work with it. And then if you're using a different library for the rest of your stuff, then start looking at what that library provides. But if you start with Dojo, you're starting from a rock solid base because you know it'll work.
I recently saw some stuff that was using, I think it called Juggernaut, it had a flash object chucked in there. I imagine that would upset you.
Yeah. I personally wouldn't do it that way. There was a question at the back, I think.
Well, the biggest problem with IE that I found is working in the large corporations and the internal departments. I think the way we could probably actually get more ground here is go to Firefox and go to Google and sort out the biggest problem they have with installing these programs is that there is no way to easily push it out across an enterprise. I mean, I spoke to our IT guys, and the thing they don't want is to have 5,000 Google Chromes out there all talking to Google to get their updates. If we can convince these companies to provide enterprise updates so we can have one update to the server, update internally, we might have more of a chance of actually getting somewhere.
Well, good point. Firefox already does it. I mean, I'm an Ubuntu user. I work for Canonical, the company who make it. We don't pull our updates from Firefox. We pull them from Ubuntu. So it's doable. I don't know if it's doable for Chrome.
But it's
certainly doable.
Their problem is sort of these are all sort of hacked or done by other people. They want something official from the top they can just take and accept. Organizations won't do this, which is the problem.
Yeah, to a first approximation, I know nothing about how you deploy software on Windows, mainly because I don't care about how you deploy software on Windows. But there will be people out there. And yeah, absolutely. Approaching Firefox and Google Chrome would be a good thing. I don't know whether Safari has something like this for the Mac, but certainly that would be worthwhile doing. If there's someone who's interested in that area, I'm sure if you went to them and said, look, I am the CTO of Ford, and we'll happily shift internally to Firefox as long as you give us a way of pushing it out, they'd wake up and do it. Anybody else? Have I got time for another one?
While we're setting up, yeah.
All right, cool. Okay, anybody else? Anyone else other than Christian? Question down the front.
I mean, as much as I say we should support browsers and not IE6, I think it's also dangerous to talk about an open web and then say, like, we're not going to support IE6 anymore. I think we should support IE6 and give it HTML and CSS.
Sorry, yes.
So that's, because that's, you would be quoted out of context in this case.
Yeah, being absolutely clear then, yes. I'm not suggesting that when you go to a page in IE6, you get a thing that says, ha, sucks to be you, Firefox only. What I'm suggesting is that you give IE6 the experience that you're giving Netscape 4 right now. If the experience for the stuff that you're building for Netscape 4 users is sucks to be you, don't use Netscape 4, then you are doing it wrong, to be clear about this. What I'm proposing is that we do exactly the same thing for IE6. We push it down into the we don't support this anymore, it's too old and broken category. Anyone else while they're setting up? Oh, thank you. No? Okay, thank you very much.